Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello, and welcome to episode 82 of the Carpcast, where we see the return of the Wandering Mark. How are you doing?
Oh, not bad, although if you would have called me wandering, that's pot and kettle, isn't it?
True, yeah, we've been away a lot this year, but yeah, did you have a good holiday?
Yeah, it was great. You know, there's some good things about Mallorca. The fact that you haven't got councils doing risk assessments and putting fences over everything, so you can just explore and find caves and holes and cliffs and do what you want.
Yeah,
did just you try not to break any bones.
And you didn't break any bones, I take it.
No, I've got a big bruise on the top of my left foot where I nearly did, but no, the only problem out there was, you know, I like a bit of swimming. The hotel was at the back of this nice long cove, which was probably about, I don't know, 200-300 metres long, so I thought, yeah, nice. Swim up and down there every morning. Only jellyfish, lots of the damn things. So that happened once. I got stung, and it was these little things. They call them mauve stingers or pink stingers. And imagine a nettle sting times about 50.
I do know there's a fairly instant cure to the pain. Did your missus help you out at all?
Apparently, if you're talking about peeing on them, it's incorrect.
Oh, is it?
When you do a little bit of research, what you're supposed to do is rub it with a credit card.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, with jellyfish, a lot of the time, they'll leave the little stinger in you.
Yeah.
And that just gets it out, although I just got some chips and a beer. That seemed to cure it. But to be honest, it was annoying. It was quite a nasty sting. But, yeah, I can deal with that. I'm a Yorkshire man, but as I was getting out of the sea, there was this poor young lass, she could only about 6 or 7 or 8, you know, and she was screaming. You know, I could see she had like a line on her arm.
Wow.
So
did you not risk it again in that bit?
Not in that bit. I did get in the sea some other places and did try the hotel pool once, but it's just full of old people bobbing around getting in the way.
Yeah, it's no good, and my swimming's fell by the wayside a little bit, actually, but when I was sort of swimming a couple of months ago, you swim twice as far in every length as what you need to, because of, like, just swimming in circles around people and kids and women, and,
you have to find a proper lane swimming place, or join an open water swimming club, go around a lake. It's a lot more fun. I've actually been out this morning. It was a nice 14.1 degrees.
Wow, that's pretty decent. We're nearing the end of October now. I did see a picture of you early this morning that you put up, looking quite trim, actually. It's the fittest I've seen you, I think, in the close to 20 years that I've known you.
Oh, fit as fuck, mate. I always have been, but yes, now I have. Over the past year, I've never weighed myself. I'm not that vain, but I just measure myself in belt notches, and I've had to make another two.
Really?
And obviously with swimming, it's a lot of upper body work, and, you know, kettlebells as well, they're good fun. And eating right. You know, I'm sure you've got Terry Edmonds on Facebook, haven't you? I think he's had a bit of a gluten intolerance thing a while back. He's been told to keep off it. He's posted a few times. He's lost a couple of stone, and he's quite a stocky little chap anyway. He'll be smashing them leads even further.
Yeah, he had a lot of upper body as well, Terry. I've seen him wallop a lead a few times. So there's not too much news this week since the last show. I've got two interviews in the bag. We spoke to Kevin Nash at length. All things Nash. I haven't had a good catch up with Kevin for a little while, and our man of the moment, we decided to get somebody who's a little bit lesser known, a chap called Alfie Naylor that I had the pleasure of talking to earlier in the week. But so it's going to be very little from Mark and I in this show, but
that'll be a relief to some.
But one thing that did just flash up, literally now, news hot off the press. It's not even association with cartfeed.com just yet, because it is literally flashed up on Facebook this second. The world record's just been broke, Mark. Have you seen that?
I've not. No, the world record or British record?
World record, 49 kilos, 108 pound from Euro record. What a carb.
Wow.
Yeah, there's pictures and videos all over Facebook right now. Literally everybody's sharing it. It's sat in, Fox have just shared it because it's sat in one of their floating cradle things. And God knows what they've made that cradle for, because there's a good bit of space all the way around a 49 kilo fish. So I don't know what they were. It must be on special delivery to Euro Aqua, that cradle, because I can't think of anywhere else where you need to use it.
The Fox Super Monster XL.
Is that what it is? Yeah, it's if it's got space. I tell you what, I saw a picture side on of the fish. There's a load of pictures knocking around. I'm sure you'll see them in a minute. I'm just seeing a picture side on of it. It looks quite a beast from looking, you know, from the head end looking down it. But when you look, when you see the sort of usual Euro Aqua pictures in front of it, it's just one of them big pale, typical Euro Aqua fish. To be honest,
Euro Simo.
Yeah, a big Euro Simo. Yes, commercially fed, great holiday venue. Yeah. If you want to get more of our thoughts on that, it was one of the early shows, wasn't it, with Ian McMillan? We did a lot on Euro Aqua.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, when you say world record, it's world biggest, but it just makes me think back to what I said a show or two ago, that I think the record, probably world record as well, should just be binned. I think they were when people can breed fish and just pump them up and artificially get them up there, where anyone with a bit of money can go and catch it. It's
yeah,
not
I mean,
record, is it? It's the biggest, but I don't know. It's not. I don't know. I just don't class it as a massive achievement. It's a holiday fish. It's just enormous.
Yeah, and it is a money lake as well. I mean, is it 2,000, 3,000 euros on the prime weeks per person? Is it that Warren guy from Manchester who's had a lot of big ones out there? What's the figure somebody told me he'd spent over there? I can't remember, but it's stupid amount of money. 2 or 3 years' wages for your average guy is what he spent over there.
Four for me.
yeah, exactly. So, you know, I don't like the setup of it. The fact that, you know, the guy's tipping barrels of maize into your swim while you're fishing every day. I don't know. It doesn't feel like fishing to me. But each to their own. We are not here to judge other people's fishing. If you enjoy it, then get out there and go and book yourself a trip and go and catch a big Eurosimo.
I would say it would be nice to offer a nice unbiased balanced view on things, but that'd also be very boring, so you get opinions. Make your own up as well.
Definitely. Well, a man with a lot of opinions is Mr. Kevin Nash. Hi Kev, you're right.
Morning Jeremy. I'm good, you?
Yes, not too bad at all. How's the weather over there?
The weather in Portugal is cloudy, dreary. Kind of hears the same as you guys over there. I think what they're saying is happening over here has been another case of horrendous fires up north, and a number of people have been killed, and that kind of dust has settled over us and the Algarve. Really weird, some of the light conditions we're getting here. I think there's talk of also dust from the Sahara Desert that's been settling on England along with the Sahara dust. Yeah, it's strange. You get some really weird light. You know, the sunrises in particular are really vivid. But hey, yeah, I'm relaxing, mate, after a long trade show, and had a chance to catch got awesome cars flying over. This is the only time I get to listen to them when I'm on a plane, and the only one I've got left is the last one where I think you talked about a trade show, which I'm looking forward to listening to that when I come home.
Yeah.
Great product launch this year. My baby, the Hive, I think has gone down well. What do you think of this, sir?
I know
you mentioned it on Carcast, but...
Yeah, you've not listened to the one where I talk about it yet, but it's fantastic. I really like the clothing. I mentioned, you've probably not heard it yet, but I mentioned the difference between RRPs and SSPs, because I absolutely love the products. A couple of comments I saw, you know, underneath usual Facebook trolling, people that just want to say it's crap. But the only things they could find to say crap about is stuff looked expensive. And then, so I explained on the last podcast about the RRPs and SSPs and the different, and Mark confirmed it working in the shop. He's like, yeah, the SSPs is all sort of, they go off. And I was like, well, it just makes the manufacturers look bad by advertising RRPs and the shops look good, whereas that's not really, you know, everybody knows what the prices they can get stuff in shops. So I know you're changing. Let's hear it from you.
Well, you know, some people in the trade probably won't thank me, but I can always only be brutally honest. The trade, or retailers generally, not just fishing tackle, run a system where, if you like, they requested we, or companies publish an inflated RRP, which price, so that when they did a deal, they would look good. Well, I think those days are well over now. You know, I've been fighting it for a couple of years now. You know, people want the most competitive price. And yes, as you see, you know, when it's been particularly relevant with the clothing, it's a fantastic range. We really upped the quality and the innovation, but you know, that comes at a price. For example, the waterproof jacket there is as good as Gore-Tex. If I remember, it's about £150, but a North Face comparison would be £400+. But then you add the RRP to it, and then I guess it's like £180. And anglers, you know, not used to, you know, clothing that sort of price, and so, you know, some can't get their head around it. So yeah, I'll put a rule in place, you know, let's be real and state the actual prices, you know, give the shops enough money they need to keep running their businesses, but you know, not to inflate it anymore.
Yeah, that's fair enough. The Titan Hide looks great as a new bivvy. I know you've were in two minds as where to place that in the market at the start, with it being sort of, you know, a lightweight brolly type sheller, and then you were going to put a front on it. And where did you finish up in the thinking of where to put it within the market?
It's a brolly, James. You know, all my life I've been a brolly angler. You know, if I go camping abroad, or do the odd long session, you know, where you need a bit of comfort or you want to keep an extra gear secure, then that's when I would get a Titan out. But most of my fishing has always been, you know, overnighters, and even throughout winter I've never fished a front because it's more time and hassle to set up. That's why the Groundhog was developed. I wanted a brolly with more depth, so if I had driving rain in my face, you know, the wind changing at night, I could just lean out of my bed chair and just pull the sticks down, so I had the front really low, so whilst the water would go part of the way in, it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't touch me on the bed chair. So yeah, I saw the potential of the Titan framework to make a lightweight minimum pack down shelter. So I designed the Hide, which originally I planned not to have a front on it, but then, you know, you get the same old thing where you're going to do one with a front, you know, and a wits and an overwrap. So kind of relented, where we just put a zip in the open doorway now, where, you know, people can zip in a Mozzie front, which I will definitely buy. You know, I don't need a waterproof front because it's quite low on the ribs, and if it, you know, if it's got that bad, I'll just get out and turn it side on the wing. But I would definitely use a Mozzie front, because the damn thing's driving mad in summer. It's not so much about getting bitten. You know, I've always said you can put a repellent on, but it's when you're just nodding off and in your ear. Yeah, that's what gets me. You know, so yeah, so we made it really flexible, but I do have to say it surpassed all my expectations. And I'm not doing a selling job, but the first time I used it was in Austria in April. I went over just basically to watch the lads and help them do their video they was putting out, you know, of a session where they all fish together. And I've gone over the week before with on a recce with Adam, and it was 18 degrees, really lovely weather. You know, we had the tide and all, we winter clobber. So we saw how lovely the weather was. So I said, right, I'm going to test the hide, which arrived 2 days before we went, the second trip. Got over there, then it transpired they had the worst weather of the winter. I woke up one morning to a snow blizzard. The wind chill was minus 20. For 3 days, I couldn't feel my feet. I thought I'd frostbite. You know, I didn't have any winter clothing, thermal socks or boots or anything. But there was one night I'll never forget. I was fishing on wood chip. The first prototype, we've got an adapter which can slip over the front rib to screw bivy sticks to, with the adapter's hand the right, so I'm just relying on pegging the hide. And I was fishing on wood chip that was really deep, and I had about only an inch of peg in the ground on each pegging point. And this wind coming, you know, just is getting night, and I'm just dozing off. You know when a big wind hits your shelter, you immediately react and try and grab the ribs or something because you think it's going to take off. Yeah. That was happening to me. I mean, well, there's nothing to grab, but, you know, but then I realised the thing wasn't moving. You know, and you can put your hand on it, on the skin, and you can feel the pressure pushing down on it. And I was just stunned. Like I said, 50 mile an hour winds hitting this hide side on, running an inch of grip of the pegs in the ground. It was an amazing bit of kit. It acts like a Formula One car. You know, the downforce actually pushes it into the ground.
Yes.
Incredible. I think the only reason you'd ever need bivy sticks is if you had a massive down blown in your face, which might uproot it. You know, so you've got something that goes up quicker than a brolly. You haven't got to mess around with storm sticks or those side sticks, which never give you much strength anyway. If you hit side on winds, it weighs 4 kilos and it's 44 inches long. Yeah, the brolly's dead. I think the brolly user will be nice. I'll never use one again.
Yeah, the only difference, maybe this is a difference between you coming from the southeast and me living most of my life in the northwest, but I've always had a bugbear about bivvies, brollies, any of them that you can't put a front on. And you know, I know Roger feels the same, and that's because we rarely go fishing and it doesn't rain at some point during the session. Quite often fishermen are on the end of winds, you know, with the winds blowing into you. So if you habitually go fishing without a zippable front on a bivvy, you're going to get wet. Or your gear's going to get wet, more importantly, your sleeping bag, and there's nothing worse than having a wet sleeping bag when you're fishing. But it's just a, you know, it's going to rain almost every session at some point if you fish 3 days a week. People in the northwest wouldn't buy a bivvy without a front on it.
No, I do agree with you. Like I said, I know I'm real hardcore. You know, there's not many anglers who fish all year through just under an umbrella. You know, and as I said, with the groundhog, I could just put it down and the water splashed near me bed, but it wouldn't go on it. But you know, I'm all about minimum time fishing, so I don't want to be messing around, you know, putting ground sheets in or fronts on and all that, because I might only have, you know, I might have arrived at night time and I'm packing up, you know, early in the morning. But I do absolutely agree with it. But like I say, we've covered that with the zipping off options.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's I mean, you know, we like fishing just the same. I've fished many years under just a brolly, but it's one of the reasons why I used to love the groundhog, because, you know, I would always have the front with me, I'd just not connected, and I'd have the facility to connect it if it rained, you know, if the wind was blowing in.
The balancing act is if you're someone really on it, you know, the more restriction you got on the front panels and a door stops you looking at the lake. That's the balancing thing, you know. So, you know, always, all my life, from dawn till dusk, well, and till I'm asleep, I'm watching the lake. You know, I won't get on my phone or anything. You know, I'll never be read books. And so I think so many people must miss out now on catching carp, because they're all always on their phone. You know, so it only takes a fraction of a second for a fish to sign his, you know, bring its shoulders out and slide back in, which is nearly always a fever. Yeah, and you can miss that. You know, so that's the main reason, I guess, why I tough it out and don't want to front on my body because I want maximum vision on the lake.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I had a situation where I was fishing somewhere where I wasn't really supposed to be, and we were fishing at nights, getting on there after dark and leaving sort of when it was getting light in the morning, and very conscious not to use any torches or anything like that in case you got spotted. And the difference between, I mean, I ended up catching both the big fish in their big commons, a lot of people know where that was from, but I certainly caught the biggest one in such a short period of time by not having a radio on, a light on, anything else, because you were sat awake up against a tree and I was hearing everything. And the difference, you know, I actually moved off the strength of it. I got a new area. The session that I caught the big one, I kept hearing fish to my right, maybe 100 yards down, which I'd never heard. If I'd have been sat how I normally fish, in a bivvy, maybe a radio on quietly or a podcast on the phone, I'd have just never heard those fish jumping sort of 100 yards away down to my right. I decided to move. I got some bait, filled it in the following night, didn't fish, then came back the night after and ended up catching a 56-pound common, or 54-pound common, I think it was at the time, purely off not having technology.
You're also right. You know, in fact, well, I haven't really told anyone yet, but I've just finished my second book, which is coming out this winter, and I talk a lot about, you know, some sessions where, you know, rather than using eyes, I locate the fish with my ears, you know, on one particular lake, Warnwell, and I realised that they would often crash out about 2 o'clock in the morning, and that was after they'd finished feeding. I think they was washing out their gills because the bottom was very gritty. So yeah, I used to set the alarm clock to wake up and just sit there listening, you know. And so there's more than one way of location, eyes and ears, and anything that detracts from that, whether it be because you can't see out the bivvy or a radio or whatever, you know, you've got to make up your mind what you want out of your carping, really, haven't you? Whether you want to get on the waters, get the job done and catch the big ones and move on, or whether, you know, you're there to chill and enjoy it along the way and wait until it happens. You know, we're all different, aren't we?
Yeah, and I go through all those, you know. Sometimes I'm going fishing for the social, sometimes I just want to be there and relaxing away from home, sometimes, you know, I'm on it wanting to catch as many as I can, and I go through all of those monthly, so yeah, it's different. But
well, I will say it's a nice thing, Jamie. I've seen you sort of calm down and, you know, chill more now, and I guess that's where I am now as well. You know, we're not young anymore, we're not the young guns that want to compete. I honestly, would I want to go in the syndicate water now? Nah, I wouldn't, you know. I'd rather enjoy it more, you know, so not bust me balls, you know, but so that's an age thing, you know.
So I've got a few notes here that you emailed me some time ago now, because we haven't spoke on the Cartercast for ages, but some comments you had about some previous stuff. I don't know if this will jog your memory, but you had a comment on Rob Hales with regard to people slating him. Do you remember what you were thinking at the time when you sent me that?
Oh, that's going back. I think I do. Yeah, I've known Rob for many years, but I've not known him closely, if you like. You know, we've probably spoken, I don't know, less than 10 times over the years. But yeah, this guy, through some lucky business decisions, made an absolute fortune. With his dad, I think I'm right. I don't know whether people know, and I hope I'm not talking out of turn here, but I think the history is that Rob's family owned the Teletubby brand. Yeah, and yeah, we all know how big that was at the time, you know, in the right place at the right time, and they made a significant amount of money. And good luck to them, because there's always mystery that I heard a story once that they had a load of containers on the sea and they thought the bubble was going to burst, and if it had a burst they would have lost everything and been bankrupt. You know, how do you sell, you know, millions of Teletubbies when suddenly the kids don't want Teletubbies? You know, but you know, the guy's earned what he's made, and he's made a great life. But, you know, but the point is, there is absolutely no way he's covering his costs and making a good living out of what he's doing now. Yeah, he's doing it because of his passion as a carp angler, but more importantly, his passion of, you know, wanting to create fisheries and, you know, create big fish in England, which is exactly, you know, I know where he's coming from, because it's the path I went down with the church and the cops. You know, so I think there's been a lot of uncharitable comment towards him. You know, I didn't actually realise the extent of his fisheries until, you know, he was on carp casts and, you know, heard about them. He's got some flipping incredible fisheries. You know, he's doing a great job in, you know, opening up lakes and making, you know, fantastic fishing available to a lot of carp anglers. So I think people should get off his back. I really do.
Yeah, it's, I think that a lot of people's problems are that this. Well, we spoke about it loads. I don't even know if I want to open up this rabbit hole again. But this, like, what's proper and what's not proper, and I think there's a very, very there's a line in the sand between commercial fisheries and natural fisheries, and I think that's the only line now, because you know, a lot of Rob's fish, they're born in England, even though they're from, you know, pedigree breed stocks. You know, he pays top dollar for some of the biggest, fastest growing strains out there. He breeds them in England, grows them in England, grows them on, and they're turning into 50s and 60s and 70s, as it turned out. But these fish have been, you know, they haven't grown in a normal fishing environment where the carp are pressured and there's competition for food and all that sort of stuff. You know, they're fed from automatic feeders, but there's many syndicates in the country that have automatic feeders in the lake to feed the fish these days. And I think that's where the divide is for me. It's, you know, there's commercial fisheries and there's non-commercial fisheries, and you're entitled to go and fish any you like on any day, given day that you want. And, you know, some days I want to go and catch some really nice old fish that, you know, if I got a chance to fish a nice little estate lake with a few 50-year-old fish, I'd go and have a go. And then if somebody says one day you want to come and fish for a load of 40s and 50s, where there's a few mates going up to this lake up here, it's day ticket and it's stuff full of big ones, like a home fen type scenario, I'd happily go and do that one day as well. You know, it's choice.
It's very complex. It's very complex, Johnny. You just said the word there, it's choice. And unfortunately, there's still too much false snobbery, you know, in this game. You know, it doesn't count and all that. Well, you know, what does count, you know, I have the benefit of hindsight and history, and, you know, the carp that people were fishing for in the 70s have been recently imported. You know, some of the most famous carp through the 70s, 80s or 90s were, you know, probably imports. You know, a massive number of fish were imported in the 70s. And I know the guy responsible for most of it, you know, in the really, sorry, you're going to hear water outside, it's from people around the earth, a bit of complex washing the pool. In the 70s, some of the most revered fish, like the ones, you know, in Ashley, you know, they were without doubt imports. Yeah, so there's nothing, you know, the only thing you can say is old scaly ones against, you know, big fat modern bred pigs. But that's, as you're trying to suggest, that is up to the person as an individual to decide what they want to fish for. And as I said before, no other angler should judge you on where you want to fish and what you want to fish for.
No, it's a hobby, and we do, you know, I like the false snobbery reference, because it is false snobbery. A lot of these people claiming proper ones that people in the know, you know, if you listen to the Alan Taylor interview that we had a month or two ago, you know, he was kind of laughing about it as well. People are hip.
But he would do, because he's been in the game as long as me, you know, and he knows a lot of the history. You know, he would do. Great interview, by the way. Big up to Adam. You know, but so, you know, he's got his feet firmly on the ground, you know, and he knows the history of carp fishing. You know, yeah, it's, we ain't gonna change it though. There's some new trolls out there.
Yeah, he knows where a lot of the fish came from, and that's why he was laughing. You know, once people, you know, people are fishing, they're laughing at other fish and fishing for the same fish themselves. Some of these people, so it like I say, false snobbery and people just not knowing the facts. Talking of interviews that you liked, I know you mentioned you had a couple of comments about Sean Harrison's interview. It was quite mind blowing to me. He just had a very logical view of things that I already knew, especially with some of the bait stuff, some of the moon stuff, some of the, you know, using the big bottom baits. I know you had some thoughts on what Sean had to say.
Well, you know, his thoughts were, you know, again, you know, Sean's old school. He used to be really close. I'll tell you a story about Sean, and on this one actually links to the previous subject. I was in the office, and I was in between waters, and there was this lad working in the local shop, which was Penjanga at the time, and he kept coming in saying, oh, I've had a 26, a 27, you know, this is in the early 90s, so, you know, good fish, you know. And I said, where are you fishing? And he told me about this water. And I said, is there any chance of getting in? And he come back, he said, oh yeah, I've had a word with the owner. If you give me the money, you're in. So I gave him the money, and I joined it. And went over there, it was a really long, thin lake. I would guess, a long time ago, 200 yards long probably, and probably 30 wide. I actually nicknamed it the river. And I got into it, and then I find out there's catfish in there, which really gets my alarm bells going, because I was, you know, probably more along the lines of some of the people that we've been talking about earlier. You know, it's an age thing, a lot of it, and maturity. And I find out that the owner, I won't mention his name, but he was a well-known importer of illegal fish. So it's been stocked with carp from Europe without the relevant paperwork, as well as cats. But do you know what? I was enjoying myself. And then to get the first section, actually, I turned up with this lad. It was a really cold December night. It was probably like -5. And he'd had all his carp under this tree in about 2 foot of water. And, right, okay, he said, well, it's very deep, you know, and this is the only place I catch. So I thought, well, my experience doesn't pan out with that. So anyway, but I did put one bait in 3 foot of water, I put another bait in 8 foot of water, and a third bait in 12, to see if I could find the feeding depth. Well, I had 4 carp that night, all on the 12 foot, and he blanked, by the way. But they all also went to the right. And I've had this thing in the past, you know, if carp always go one way, that's where they've come from, and that's where they live. A little tip here, yeah? So the next session I moved down. Cut a long story short, after 4 sessions, I found Carp City and where they was living in the winter. Yeah? And I smashed that place. But anyway, so I was in contact with Sean, blah, blah, and the following, I told him there was cats in there, and this is a time when he's really into his cat fishing. And so he said, can I come over and session? So he come up. It was one autumn day. In fact, Jeff Pink was also down there with me. And I went right up one end, and Sean was right up the other end, so like 150, 200 yards apart. And I woke up in the middle of the night, I've had a single bleep on my left hand rod, and then a single bleep on my middle rod, and then a single bleep on my right hand rod. I thought, what's going on here? Then I heard Jeff shout that Sean was into a fish. Then I've had a bleep on my middle rod and one on my left hand rod, and I realised he's hooked a big cat and he's come right to the upper end of the lake and it's gone from our lines. So we've gone up there, and after an immense battle of about an hour, Sean's got this thing in the edge, which there's no way it was going to the landing there. It's so huge. So I pulled my hoodie off, put it over my hands, stuck it in its maw, and we pulled it up the bank with some difficulty. I tell you, anyway, cut a long story short, it was a catfish that went 105 pounds.
Wow.
It was covered in this horrible thick mucus slime, and it smelt like a dead dog. I guess it had been eating bodies. So, and the three of us were struggling with this bloody thing. By the time we finished, it was all soaking wet, covered in this slime, and we smelt like dead dogs. And I just looked at Sean. I said, are you serious? He said, you know, I think I've caught enough cats now. And to my knowledge, you never went catfishing again. But thank God. I said to him, I wasn't going to invite him back if he wanted to fish for him again there. But yeah, you know, the guy, you know, he's got so much experience. And the big thing with Sean, you know, he's one of these people who managed to keep a diary. You know, I've tried in my life, it lasted 5 minutes, but he has religiously kept his diaries. And so there's a lot of data, you know, to go out there, you know, and he's a thinking angler. So, you know, a lot of that stuff is really interesting. Obviously, I knew about the moon and all that, but you know, little things like the small carp reference.
Yeah.
I thought that was so interesting, so interesting. You know,
yeah, the younger, you know, ones and the older ones.
Yeah, because, you know, I don't actually think the full moon is particularly productive for carp. What I think it's productive for is the biggest. And I've always had this thing, well, you know, the smaller carp don't feed on the full moon, and so the big ones have a chance to get to the food. But it's more, you know, it could be back to this instinct thing. The small ones are hiding up, you know, and so the big ones are left on their own. And, you know, so there's less competition. As we know, big fish don't like competing, and loads of the young guns, so maybe that's what it's all about, a good opportunity for them to have a good feed and not be harassed by other carp having a go. That was a fascinating interview, and big up to Sean for that one.
Yeah,
Gary Wood had something to say about him reckoning he developed Amber Tractor for us, by the way. He for sure helped us tweak it, but I think Gary will say no, he didn't actually bring the Amber Tractor to us, but yeah, that won't go down in history and who remembers what, but no. Yeah, great lad, great angler.
Talking about bait, I know you wanted to correct me. I was discussing last week about some of Danny Fairbrass's comments about shelf life boilies, and I didn't know the full facts about your stabilised range, but all I did know is that they don't use preservatives, and they're pretty good for the fish. In fact, it's pretty much all I use these days. But I know you wanted to correct me on the egg because you don't use powdered egg.
I'm not saying Gary doesn't use powdered egg, but we don't use powdered egg as a substitute for fresh egg. You know, we always prided ourselves that, you know, our baits are mixed with fresh egg. You know, and this is at a time when I know other companies weren't necessarily using liquid fresh egg, and I believe it's one of the edges of a superior bait. You know, so I'm a little bit horrified there. And it also is one of probably the factors that helps the baits blow up. You know, even our stabilised, you know, will blow up, you know, so they're not left rotting on the bottom. You know, I can understand the concerns of some fishery owners. I've seen it myself with, I don't know about today, but certainly in the past, you know, some companies were using some pretty toxic preservatives and the baits wouldn't blow up, so they were rotting on the bottom. But I'd like to think we're in a new world now where that doesn't happen. Yeah, I did find Danny's comments a bit strange. You know, knowing Danny and where he comes from, it makes me wonder if he's planning on buying mainline in the future.
Well, mainline, I was also corrected by Mark, who works in the fishing shop. I think mainline do a... I forget which one it was now, but they do a boiler that doesn't go off. I hate using the word shelf life these days because it conjures up the wrong thoughts. I mean, if you fished for a number of years, if you fished since the 80s and 90s, I mean, keeping bait fresh was always an issue. We didn't have some of the equipment that we've got these days. You know, I remember reading articles about people using vacuum flasks and stuff and would only use, you know, frozen bait straight out of a vacuum flask. There was all sorts of weird and wonderful ways people used to... We used to have to adapt and find solutions for problems, whereas now if there's a problem, some companies solved it and made a product that you can buy that'll get around whatever said problem is, I guess. But back then...
I like it like this, yeah. If you was around the 60s or 70s and you went into a groceries or a supermarket, yeah, the limit of available foods, and especially if they was preserved, whether it be fried bent or steak pies in a tin, yeah, the technology was nowhere near it is now. Yeah, I always use frozen bait, but I'm not at all bothered now, because I know our stabilised baits are at least as good, possibly even better. You know, it was Dr. Keith Sykes who came up with the way that we make our baits now, so-called shelf life, but it's using, you know, the latest cutting-edge technology from the food industry, and, you know, people are eating foods from supermarkets that have the same process all day long, and I would add at the high prices, this system is being used in a lot of, premium products that you find in Waitrose, and the jury's out with me, so I find myself using stabilised more than I do frozen. I kind of mix them in the summer,
yeah,
because I instinctively feel possibly I'm getting different attractor levels from the frozen and the stabilised, so have the best of both worlds. But in winter, I think I get the edge for the stabilised now. I think the stabilised give out better traction in cold water. So I'm still not entirely clear on it. I haven't, done me normal and really done a lot of testing, side by side like I used to do. But I'm more of a stabilised fan now than I am of a frozen. I never thought I would say that.
Yeah, I mean, I've fished abroad a lot this year, and obviously if you go in, I was away for 4 weeks on one of the trips, and if you're taking bait with you, it's just impossible to take frozen bait. So, but I've had, I was saying to Roger the other day, I think this year I've probably had as many fish as I've caught in the last 10 years proper fishing, which opens up a whole load of new things. First of all, it gives you confidence because your buzzers are going regularly. Secondly, it gives you confidence in the bait that you're using, gives you confidence in playing fish, landing fish. You get your ratios pretty accurate. But when you're fishing low stock lakes and you say, I only drop off about 1 in 10 fish on my rigs or whatever, when you're actually catching 70 fish, 80 fish, 90 fish,
that's where you learn.
It's a much better sample size. I do lose more fish than I used to claim. There's no two ways about it. It was probably just too small a sample size to judge before, but I definitely, a couple of times I lost two on the bounce, and it's like, why? On the rig that I've been raving about, or the Ronnie rig or whatever, and I've just dropped two off in a row. How's that happened? And it's because the sample size is more accurate when you're getting 70 bites, 80 bites, 100 bites in a year. You get to realise. But it's given me the confidence in bait, and I've used stabilised the Scopex squid pretty much all year, and I've caught every time I'm supposed to have caught. Never have I been sat there thinking I should have had a bite now.
But there is a big point here, Jamie, which I'm absolutely convinced on. Take your frozen bait abroad and then air dry it, and you are badly impacting on that bait's attractiveness. You really are.
Right.
A stabiliser outfished air dry baits any day of the week.
Yeah, I agree. And I like the fact that you say they will rot on the bottom and they will float up, blow up, float up, whatever you want to call it, which is kind of key, I think. Was it Rob Hales actually who drained the monument down? I remember reading an article many years ago, one of the years he drained the monument down, and it was full of bait off the bottom. There was a lot of it, I think. I need to speak to Rob about that actually and remind myself, because it was years ago. But
it did happen. I'm not going to point fingers because neither in existence now, but I know two bait companies who the baits didn't pop up. It did happen, but let's put it this way. I always feed the church and the cops with stabilised baits, and the new lake, and these are my babies. Would I do it? If I thought there was any risk to the fish, and the amount we put in over the years, that bait was sitting on the bottom rotting, the fish wouldn't be there now. They'd be dead, simple as that. I'd have a pneumonia breakout and killed them all.
Yeah. Tell us about the cops. I know a little bit, but you've got a new project really, haven't you? The new lake, the cops, what are you actually doing down there now?
Well, we dug a new lake, which is called the Red Lake, because I planted it with red lilies. And it's given me the opportunity to if you like, going the next adventure, we have a big blanket weed problem on the copse. This is, again, a problem that I've seen manifest, you know, certainly the last 10 years. It certainly never used to be such a bad problem on waters in the UK. And I think it's down to higher temperatures through the year. When I bought Cabinac, it was 49 acres of lilies and 1 acre of water. And we cut all the lilies out. The next thing that caused was, you know, trying to fight nature. And a massive blanket weed problem. It was impossible to fish, basically. You had this blanket weed, you know, subsurface all over the whole lake. I'd give a lot of people back their money and cancelled trips. But I got a specialist in, and he said, well, the cycle is 6 weeks. He said, then it would be too hot, it would blow to the surface and die. And he was so right. But what happens in England, you know, the stuff lives all year long. You know, we don't seem to get the high enough summer temperatures to blow it up and kill it. You know, the copse, again, because of the clay bottom soaking in the warmth, it's been a particularly bad problem. And so now I've got the new lake, and I had somewhere to move the copse fish to. And this winter we're going to drain it, and I'm going to go through, say, a new journey of trying to revitalise the lake. I once heard that the lake's its most richness for the first 15 years. You know, it goes downhill, you know, silt builds up and all that. So it's going to be an interesting project, you know, to start again, if you like, on the copse.
So what you can do, just scrape bottom, fertilise it, and I don't really know what you do to lake bottoms, having never had one.
Well, we'll pump it. I've got an issue with getting a digger on there and scraping it, because to get a digger in would do so much damage on the site. I just don't want to go back there again and have to, you know, go through those years of seeing nature restore itself. So I'll probably pump it down to, you know, what would be a sump hole, you know, the deepest little place where there'd be water left. We'll then lime all the bottom. Probably put a rotivator through it, you know, when it's dried out next summer, you know, and basically get some life into the bottom, and, you know, enrich it, get some air into it so it's a rich bottom again. Then I'm slowly going to fill it and plant it, give the plants maximum opportunity to establish themselves, rather than fill it to the top, and, you know, plants are struggling with the light level if it's too deep. I've just put probably 2 foot of water in it, plant it all out so the plants have a massive opportunity to flourish, which will stop the blanket weed getting hold again. You know, step by step, see it as another 4-year project, 5-year project, like I did with the lakes originally, and say, get all the natural life going, and probably put the fish in about 3 years' time.
And it says here, gudgeon. What does that mean?
I've got a big thing about gudgeon. You know, yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned it a couple of times on Carp Talk, you know, you have the discussions about, you know, carp being predatory. They are significantly predatory when it comes to eating, you know, other fish. I've seen it since the 70s, but gudgeon is one they particularly like. You know, I was on a lake called Lake Meadows in the 70s, you know, and we was a dog's bollocks, carp anglers, all our specials, you know, rods up at our armpits, you know, fishing bottle tops and all that. And this scruffy old carp, piker turned up, fished dead bait gudgeon, and caught 4, you know, that afternoon. I don't think we've had 4 fish all winter, you know, so I noted that. But I don't know who told me, some while ago, I was told that someone who had a fish tank with all the species in it, carp, roach, bream, they all lived happily. And you got hold of some gudgeon and you put them in the tank, and the next day they're all gone. So I think carp really do love gudgeon, and it's relevant that, you know, Redmar, you know, had gudgeon in it when those carp were stocked, and, you know, look how big they got to. So yeah, we stocked the Red Lake with gudgeon, and I should definitely put them across to the copse. You know, much better food source than trying with crayfish, of course, which, you know, do ultimately make carp very big, but, you know, there's nothing else left living in the lake with crayfish, and of course it makes the fishing so difficult. So gudgeon's another form of, you know, me trying to find food sources which are, you know, big and have a big protein content, you know, like the frogs. You know, we put some cray traps in the Red Lake to trap the fly. It's, you know, because they bred this year. And some of the tadpoles, Jamie, you know, as I said before, you know, people 4 inches long and 18 mil bodies. You know, I don't think people would believe me until they've seen them in the office. You know, they were huge, you know. So, and that's what it's all about. If you want really big fish, you've got to give them a Richard's environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never found a lake that's got crays in where the carp aren't absolutely huge. But the problem is with crays is they make, you know, for us carp, lazy carp anglers especially, they make fishing really tough. You know, they are definitely a big nuisance. So, yeah, gudgeon. What's the biggest a gudgeon can go? It's never going to be big enough to eat a boil, is it? I would have thought.
Well, I don't know. I lose track. You know, I still talk about, you know, 6-8 pound bream being massive. And someone told me the other day the record's over 20 pounds. You know,
yeah.
A 5 pound tench used to be the equivalent of, you know, a 30 pound carp. Now, I don't know what the tench record is. You know, I thought gudgeon grew to 8 ounces, but maybe they're going to double figures now, which would be interesting.
I've always said
if I'd ever caught the carp record, I'd never claim it. I don't know what that's about, but oh, I would so love to catch the gudgeon record and claim it. My sense of humour, that appeals to me. I do mean to, I am going to wander over to the Red Lake, you know, float fish it a few times and see how big those gudgeon have got, because we put the gudgeon in 2 years before we put the carp in, so they've had 2 years to, you know, really thrive.
Interesting. I used to like catching gudgeon from the canal. I've not seen one in years, but I used to quite like them. Interesting.
Well, it's funny you mention it. I think the last gudgeon I caught on the hook and line was probably in the 60s in the Chelma Canal before it got polluted. Yeah. Not so common now, are they?
I've not seen one for years, but it's interesting what you're saying about Redmire. They're obviously a good strain of fish that went in there, but they did do remarkable things, and there's usually a reason in nature, isn't there, behind that. Yeah. I know you identified frogs and tadpoles, for the church lake many years ago, and there's a lot in there, because I've spent many a night not being able to sleep with the noise in the spring on there many years ago. But you mentioned at the very start of the chat about the new book. What's in it? What's the general theme?
It carries on from the first book, which is, memoirs of a carp fishing demon. No, it was really my frustration with the modern carp world, and, you know, anger's just been told, you know, get a bucket of spod mix, spom it out, you know, cast out, and you're going to be a carp angler. You know, I really didn't like the way the marketing was going, and to my mind, talking to anglers on the phone, how disillusioned they were with the scene, because, you know, they thought they'd been given a promise, and then, you know, it didn't manifest into the results, and then enjoying their carp fishing. So the book basically was a number of chapters where I picked a lake where I hoped there'd be a good yarn, but more importantly, I was trying to illustrate the learning curve you have to go through, the apprenticeship, if you like, and the thinking process. So the second book carries that on until it got to a point where I close it down in quite a dramatic form. And then it's actually two books in one. So the first book is called, first half of the book is called Herman's Hole. The second half is called The Knowledge, where I basically reiterate and go over everything I learned, well, not everything, the major things that I learned along the way, and trying to put it into a logical process that I hope anglers will understand, although some of it is very technical. You know, I hope they'll understand, and so it will help improve their carp fishing and, you know, help them catch a whacker along the way.
Excellent. So it's I like the knowledge side of it. I mean, but we know from the carp cast that the most popular episodes are the ones that get people's brains ticking over, the ones that where people learn and come away thinking, I'm going to try that, I want to do that, or, you know, what if I adapt my rig a little bit, or, you know, what if I apply this baiting? People want to learn, don't they? So,
I will say, you know, some might find it basic, you know, for example, the blowout rig, a lot of it is about that, because, I developed it, and I continue to talk about it, more from the point of view of trying to get anglers to get into their head the process of how a rig works and the kind of things they need to establish to identify if they should use a rig or not. Yeah, you know, it's more about, you know, I've done, for example, going to pop-up rigs, you know, or chod rigs. You know, I just go into the stuff that, you know, I think I had a lot of experience in and helped to develop, you know, for the betterment of carp fishing. You know, so it's not a complete technical book telling you, you know, all the latest rigs or all that, far from it. You know, it's just trying to illustrate the thought processes to get you from A to Z.
Yeah, that's the key thing, isn't it? Having the right thought process helps you work out your own things, as opposed to,
exactly,
oh, look at that rig there, so-and-so's catching lots of fish in it, I'm going to try that. You know, they're the bits I like. When I used to have a lot of rig chats in the early days with people I'd meet on the bank and other people who were thinking like me, when we don't really know the answers, it's just try different things. I mean, I think still to this day, our most listened to Carpcast episode is the rig one with Roger, yourself and me, in your kitchen, I think it was.
The messy night of the brandy, but you know, the mentor's got to be, if you don't understand why you're doing it, don't do it. Yeah, I think that's what the mentor needs to be.
Understand,
you know, that is the only way you'll learn and progress, if you understand why you're doing something.
Yeah, well, maybe that's a nice note to leave it on. I look forward to reading the book. When is it out?
Early November it'll be out.
Fantastic.
And that's my lot. You know, there'll never be, well, just like, you know, I bowed out of ever doing any more film work, there'll never be another book for Meshy again. You know, they take a lot of time and, you know, it's draining and, I just felt people were, I hope it doesn't sound egotistical, but a lot of people pushed me to do the first book and said, you need to do a second book. In other words, you know, put down all my experience on record, you know, and that's really what I've tried to do and achieve. There's no reason why I should ever need to put pen to paper again. You know, I've said everything I think I need to say, really, to help anglers, you know, going forward.
The final book.
I could read a whole book on location, for example, but yeah, you know. Sorry?
The final book account, it could have been called.
yeah. It could have been, you know, like the final count in DVD, but yeah, we used that on the DVD.
I don't know if you've heard in the latest podcast or not, but I know we spoke about it last week, Kevin, and that was the my concern about getting youth into the sport. I know you're quite passionate about it, and myself with the fishing show is obviously a concern for us long term, that people are starting fishing in the right way as well. I think for the longevity of it, I think a danger with being an instant carp angler is you can literally in your second session, you know, book a trip on somewhere like Home Fen or one of Rob Hales' day ticket lakes, catch a 50 pounder or maybe a 60 if you're really lucky, and that progression of learning, like, you've hit the peak. When you don't work for something, it's not as big of a deal, is it? So I think it's important to, you know, have achievements, goals, achieve and move up. And I think in anything, that's important. And there is a danger where if you have enough money or the right person take you to the right lake, you could bypass all that and then maybe not get the lifetime of happiness out of it that we've had.
Well, yeah, so that's really what me two books are about, Jamie. But yeah, I think you're also, you know, we had a conversation last week, you're very concerned about how few youngsters are coming into fishing. And it is a problem. You know, it's a problem which I think I told you I don't really know. Well, I know the answer, I just don't know how the answer can be applied. I'll just give you a little bit of history. We have tried a number of ways over the years. Probably about 8 years ago, we went into the local school, Greenswood Academy, because I found out that disaffected kids could get evicted from school, expelled, if they never attended, I think it was Maths, English and Science, and I don't know what to say now, but at that time, it was this horrendous system government put in place that schools had to score points to get the funding or whatever. And so if kids weren't turning up for school, rather than score, lose their points, they would just expel them. So you know, that really does solve the problem, doesn't it? But I went and saw the headmaster because I was passionate about putting something back into this school, because my youngest, Joe, he caused me some problems in his school. When he went to Greenswood, they really sorted him out, or he really got it then, and now he's on an incredible career. So I felt kind of obliged to put something back in there. So I went and saw the headmaster, and we discussed it, and what he said was that, in effect, we could set up a fishing class, and the kids could learn about fishing in school time. They would be allowed to have 2 days off a week, to go fishing. Thinking, wow, I wish there was when I was at school. But I made the point to him that, it wasn't about taking them fishing. It was more about getting them to understand, the importance of education, and it could actually be enjoyable. So we laid out this format where we set up these lectures where one day a week we'd go in and do a lecture, for example, on how to create a fishery. And then another day we'd take them to a shop and explain how the shop worked and setting all that, just in case one of the gobby little kids, and I mentioned that, remembering one of them, could have the potential to be a salesman. And this is a process we went through, and we used to take them fishing as well. If that's a carrot, if they all attended school, then they could go on fishing sessions. We did this for a year, me or Alan doing the lectures with this teacher who was passionate about fishing, and he had a right result. He didn't have to teach normal kids anymore. He could just do this thing and then spend half his school year fishing, and it worked really well, and all those kids were saved from being expelled, and they then went on, and I think at least 2 of them ended up working for me, and others went to college, blah blah. We did it the second year, and again it went really well. But what I then, my plan was to then video it and roll it out nationally. But what we realised, that unless me, or it got more to the point, Alan did the lecture, it didn't work. The teacher wasn't up to it, and so from that, I was really disillusioned, thinking this is never going to work, because unless we replicate me and Alan around the schools around the UK, it's never going to be a success. So we regrettably had to give it up, although we still do have some input. But meanwhile, also going along, we're doing various fishing things, and every summer holiday we did an event on a reservoir called Rochford Reservoir in the middle of Rochford near Southend. Basically, it was advertised, kids who want to learn fishing, come for the day. And huge event. You wouldn't believe the number of kids would turn up. And he was really chuffed with that. But then I saw the flaw in that. The parents were just turning up with their kids, dumping them so they could have a day doing what parents wanted to do, go shopping or whatever, and then they pick the kids up in the evening, kids have a great day, and that's it. That's the end of their fishing experience, because the parents didn't fish, parents weren't taken fishing. So it was a great fun day for the kids, a great day for the parents to get rid of the kids, but it couldn't go any further. Anyway, I was talking about this with a guy called Nick North, who, when I was in Rayleigh Angling Club, he was a fellow junior, he's now the chairman, and again, I felt a kind of obligation to Rayleigh Angling Club, because if I hadn't joined Rayleigh Angling Club, which had carp in it, I may not have had the amazing life I've had. And he was talking about it, and he said to me they didn't have a junior section anymore, which horrified me. He said, the seniors couldn't be asked for it. And so I said, well, would you be interested in starting it again? He said, yes. As an aside, by the way, in the meantime, I did a check, and I was shocked how many angling clubs now don't have a junior section, because the seniors, know, don't have to put up with them. Now, how can we get kids into the sport if there's nowhere for them to fish? Unless they can find a derelict farm pond, which, you know, we do when we were kids, but there's not many of them around now. We talked in great depth about this and the flaw in the Rotchen Reservoir thing. So I come up with the idea where, or we come up with the idea that we do six lessons in school holidays, mornings or afternoons, short sessions, and the condition was each kid had to have an adult with them. And then after six lessons, we had a match at the end, and then they got free membership until they were 16. We've now been running it 3 years, and every year is getting bigger and bigger. I think the first year we had eight. I think this year there's been 24 kids going through it. And it's quite interesting, actually, how many mums have now taken up fishing because of it. Yeah. But as I said to you, you know, when we were talking about it, James, you know, I can do this on a local level, but again, we can't roll it out nationally. You know, and you know, the clear point to me is that kids don't all want to be stuck in a bedroom, you know, on the computer or whatever. In fact, sadly, I found out that Greenswood, which, by the way, is an affluent area, you know, but with a high level of dysfunctional kids, it's because their mum and dad is just throwing money at them for gadgets rather than taking them out in the countryside, you know, and giving them some time. You know, there is a percentage of kids who love being outside, would love to take up fishing, but you know, they can't get to the lakes, you know, because, you know, the parents, you know, don't go fishing. They can't sit by the lake because most clubs won't allow juniors, or, you know, you've also got to be very aware of insurance needs nowadays. You know, you can't have kids under 16 on the lake unless they're accompanied by a guardian. It's the same for us at Royston. So the key to me is if we want to expand the sport and get kids into it, we've got to get a guardian or a parent fishing with them. And that's a difficult one. It really is. I say we're doing it locally, but we can't do it nationally. You know, it needs, if you like, a network of clubs to, you know, all get involved and, you know, start doing this together. That might be the way, but here's a really sad fact for you. The first year we did this Rayane Club venture, Nick, the chairman, sent a letter out to 70 members, you know, saying, you know, anyone want to come along and help? To this day, not one member has come along and helped.
Wow.
Yes, it clears my office out now to do these events. You know, I've got no problem with that, but all the lads, you know, all the fishing lads in the office and the warehouse, you know, because it's growing so big now, have to come along, you know, to this fishing event. 70 members in the club, not one of them helps.
Wow.
So there's so much apathy and selfishness, you know, towards, you know, the next generation.
It's a shame.
Yeah, yeah, that's my experiences, mate.
But people are selfish, but you know, they might think, you know, we don't want the banks busier, or we don't want kids running about the banks. But at the end of the day, fishing saved a lot of people. You know, a lot of people from inner city areas. You know, including somebody who admits it himself, Roger. You know, he's brought up in a very rough part of Manchester.
Me as well.
Yeah.
But again, this one covers that. If you get a guardian or a parent going with them, you know, they will manage them, you know, on the fishery. Or if some members would get involved, you know, when I was in Rayane Club, we had a regular match scene for juniors with a match every 2-3 weeks, you know, and there would be one or two seniors in attendance. You know, it's all it needs, you know. It don't...
Yeah, it's how we do it on
when I was 12 or whatever, I didn't go fishing every night, you know, I just needed me fixed, and then, you know, it just kept me in it, and then when I, you know, got older, you know, then, you know, I really took it on. It's just getting them interested, you know. I'm doing it with my grandson now, you know, we got him in on it, and, you know, he's always gagging to go fishing, but he can't go much because of his what his parents, you know, get up to. But you know, he's probably now fishing once every 2 months, but he's absolutely fanatical about it. So if you like, being starving him isn't doing any harm. And I know as soon as he gets older and he's able, he's going to be, you know, an avid angler, you know?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's the luck of the draw as well to get into it. I mean, we moved when I was young from an estate to into the country just a little bit, and there just happened to be a farmer's pond at the back. I'd had no interest in fishing, but it's only because I'd never come into contact with fishing. You know, I hadn't heard of it, would never imagined it was going to be a hobby, let alone, you know, be as big a part of my life as it has. But I happened to, we moved house, there was fields at the back, there was a little pond in it, the local kids on the street used to fish it, and I caught a perch, and I was addicted from that minute, you know, that I caught my first fish. And it, that was just luck and opportunity. And, all right, maybe it didn't help me all the time. I actually used to sky school to go fishing. I was that into it, you know, once I joined a club, and there was actually a really good lake walking distance from my house, and it probably contributed to a bit less education for me. But, you know, education isn't always... there's a lot of people don't know what they want to do at school, and then they find their own path, and I was certainly one of those. People that you know discovered that I wanted to do things that made me happy, and one of those things was fishing. I would have never had, if there wasn't a farmer's
My story is similar. Not one fishing member in my family. I just went popped down to a farmer's pond to see a couple of mates, and you know, they were fishing, and that's how I got into it. Yeah, I wasn't doing well at school, and I have no doubt, you know, I would not have had the amazing lucky life I've had, you know, if it wasn't for fishing, you know, and it saved me from possibly, you know, an untoward route in life, you know, so, yeah, and that's why I'm so passionate about it, and that's why, you know, so I really want to get this scheme off in Greenswood, you know, because those scallywags we had, you know, when I said to the headmaster, the deal is that, you know, the hook is fishing, you know, we only want kids who would like to go fishing or have been, because then I knew how to hook, and you know, and so with that hook, oi, you know, if you don't turn up to your lessons, we're not taking a fishing, you know, so you can use it, you know, as an advantage to help, you know, kids who, you know, are not, you know, going the right direction, but it is difficult, you know. I think in summary, enough adults are prepared to help and assist, you know, the next generation of kids to be anglers for whatever reason, you know, A, because it would be good for them, or B, well, it would always be good for them to get them outside, but you know, unless enough adults are prepared to help kids, the next generation, then it's going to continue to decline.
There is support from the government. I spoke about this on the show that you haven't listened to yet with Leon Bartrop, and since then I've had an email for a guy called Dean Asplin. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's Partnership Development Manager for the South for the Angling Trust, and his job is basically to help get people into angling.
So what have they achieved? You know, sorry, but you know, I had no belief in the Angling Trust. You know, people working there, you know, they're getting paid by the government, that's how they're salaried, but I've never seen anything particularly constructive come out of the Anglers Trust to help course anglers or to bring people into the sport.
Well, I should counter that with what he said in this email. He's saying since April the 1st, 2017, we've run 300 events nationally, 6,500 participants, 4,000 of them being juniors, through two programs, Let's Go Family Fishing, which is free family fishing to motivate the whole family. So it's kind of along the lines of what you're pushing.
Yeah, I'm heartened by that, and I'd love to eat me words,
And Get Back Into Angling, which was a free 4-hour initiative to allow more adults who've had a gap in angling for whatever reason. You know, maybe they've had...
Right, well, that's going in the right direction, I'd say, if it's done similar, to my findings.
We should... I'm reading this email for the first time now. I knew that I'd been sent an email. I'm just going through it. So I am heartened that, that you know, the powers that be are aware and they're coming up with these schemes. I know Rob Hughes was working with them for a bit, and I know he had the spring into fishing. I know they like these campaigns, the Angling Trust. I'm heartened to see that they had 4,000 juniors out of 6,500 participants. But I didn't know about it. I'm finding out about this for the first time, and this has happened. Mm-hmm. You didn't know about it. So there's clearly a... I mean, is there one in the north? Yes. Is there one of these in the north? Dean, if maybe you could get back to me and let me know who the northern coach is, because I'd like to get him to the... sorry, not coach, but the guy doing your job in the north. I'd like to get him to the Northern Angling Show this year. The Angling Trust attend the Angling Show anyway, the EA attend, and all the local clubs. It'd be nice if maybe we could get everybody together. And not people say, you know, we've always supported, everybody gets free stands that are working within the industry like that. The Angling Trust get a free stand at our show, the EA get a free stand, and so do all the local clubs, the Prince Albert Angling Society, Warrington Anglers, Lim Anglers, because it's good for the kids. Young kids are free in our show, and if they can go and chat to their local club, maybe become a member. You know, we've been doing that since show one, and
but James, yeah, I'm, you know, that's all great stuff, yeah, but yeah, you're going to be talking to a lot of the converted. Yeah, I had a great conversation with one of my sales team, lad called James Massey, great lad, intelligent, Midlands based, and we was talking about how we got into fishing, and the point we were both making is that we didn't and would never have walked into a tackle shop. You know, my first fishing rod come in a wooden case. I think it was a trout rod with two tips that I bought in Woolworths. You know, it's one of the first products probably come out of China. Horrendous thing, you know, for two sessions. You know, the tip was set. You know, James's first fishing rod come from Argus.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the point I'm trying to make is, yes, you know, it's great to talk to people interested in fishing, but they come to your show because they're interested in fishing. The main point could be to get the clubs to go along to a stand at your show to try and get the clubs to get engaged in getting to these kids who aren't into fishing.
Yeah.
You know, like things the scheme I'm talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely agree. Like, they've already got an interest in fishing to be attending a fishing show. But I mean, we're trying to help that with the, you know, with the kids go free. So I mean, maybe you've got a passing interest. At least you can go and have a look around without committing any money to it. You know,
if you did an event within the show, i.e. similar to what we do at Rochford, yeah, you market it to mums to bring their kids along, to have like an hour of fishing experience, don't think you have water there, whatever, but, you know, if you marketed it outside the angling community as an event for, you know, mums and dads, bring your kids along, and see this amazing fishing experience, market it outside. And I mean, try and, you know, model an event just for those sort of people coming along.
That's a great idea. I'm making a note of that as we speak. Mums and kids outside of fishing. Yeah, I mean, it's something that the local newspapers would get on board with. If we're doing something like this, and obviously anything that helps with getting kids into fishing and can maybe promo the NAS show as well is obviously a good thing for us. So, market event, mums and kids outside of fishing.
Mums, dads and kids, yeah, come and see the fishing experience. Yeah.
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 I like that. That's a nice note to leave that little topic on.
Great.
Well, enjoy the rest of your holiday. I hope to bump into you next week. I'm in your neck of the woods. Got a group of lads on the church. See if we can do another PB. I think every week for the last 4 weeks, one or more anglers have had the PB on there. So, hoping for another next week.
Who's down this week? Anyone you know this week?
It's not one of my trips, but it is friends of Roger's that they booked it off their own back, and they came in the spring. Actually, I think they had a couple of big ones in the spring, but I don't know what they've had this week. I heard it had fished slow. They've been half yesterday. I think they'd been half a dozen bites, mainly on zigs, but nothing massive. But maybe someone's had a kipper since then that you may know about.
Well, I think I heard at the beginning of the week that a couple of lads have had fish around 38, which were PBs. Yeah. And that is a wonderful thing about a church. You know, I stopped counting at over 200 anglers that had had PBs. You know, wow. As you say, nearly the majority of weeks this year, you know, an angler's had a PB, and it's so great to see their smiley faces. You know, it makes it all worthwhile, all the blood, sweat, and tears on creating that fishery.
Yeah.
So I'm back Tuesday, so I'll see you over the next week, then.
Good to speak to you, Kevin. I'll speak soon.
And you, fella. Have a good weekend. Bye.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So thank you very much to Kevin. We move on with our interviews, and next up is... So I'd like to welcome to the podcast a man that's been requested many, many times, a guy that I hope to find a lot about, because I've not heard too much in the past, but he comes highly recommended. So please welcome Mr. Alfie Naylor. How are we doing, pal?
Not too bad. How's yourself?
Yeah, good, good. So... whenever we've requested guest suggestions, your name's come up a few times. I must confess to not knowing too much, except you live in the Nottingham area, is that right?
I do, yeah. I live in Newark, just outside Nottingham.
And the people that have shouted your name up, they say you're a bit of an expert on the rivers. You've got a fantastic river there, haven't you, with the River Trent?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I've been very blessed over the last 3 years. The Trent's probably 100 yards from the back door, so it's quite a blessing. You can imagine, as an angler, it's brilliant to be able to come home from work and it's just there.
So do you fish off like out the back garden type thing? Do you fish your local bit regular?
No, I fish the local bit, but I don't tend to fish too close to home. I tend to get where we are is like a new housing estate, and on one side of it you can't fish, so you've got one bank that's out of bounds, but you have to walk all the way around into like a cow field.
Yeah,
so you can kind of get down there and fish that bit.
So I know the Trent's got some history for big carp. I mean, just tell us sort of what's the average fish stock in a stretch? Do you fish for all species there, or just carp?
No, to be honest with you, I do fish for pretty much everything. I try and keep it as seasonal as possible. You get preoccupied, because if you start getting some really big barbel, you tend to turn the blind eye to the carp and start concentrating on the barbel a bit more when they're feeding.
Yeah.
So you do tend to spend a bit more time searching for all different species, to be honest. And me personally, is I love my carp, but I also love to fish for anything else as well. I've had some incredible fish out there. I've had chub to 8 pounds.
Yeah, and that's a big chub.
It's huge. I honestly thought it was a grass carp when I landed it. Yeah. It was huge. Until them big rubber lips come to the net, I was like, wow, it's a serious fish.
And how big did the barbel go in there?
The biggest I've witnessed myself is 15.7, but I have heard rumours of 18s.
Wow. And then the carp, it had a very famous ghostie, didn't it, years ago, the Trent?
It did, and it's quite funny actually, because where that famous ghostie is, it's actually, I'm actually fishing that stretch where it was.
Yeah.
It's not been out for a long, long time. And to be completely honest with you, this season the carp have not been here as much as they usually are. Obviously, with the Trent, it changes every season. And I'm 99.9% certain that as soon as the locks open, the fish do naturally go in and out the locks. So every year your stock seems to change.
Right. Is different stretches controlled by different clubs? Can you just roam up and down freely?
Well, this section here, I'm a member of the Newark Piscatorials. Mm. So for this section, obviously we can only fish certain areas. When you go further upstream and further downstream, then both areas, again, they're bailiffed by the Nottingham Federation as well. So it's quite strict where you can and can't go. So you're pretty much stuck to your books, really.
So if, like, I'm guessing location is one of the big factors then. Is it a lot more looking than fishing if you're trying to locate them on the river?
Yeah, to be honest with you, my fishing, I've got a young family, so my fishing really is concentrated on very short sessions. Yeah. And when I say short sessions, it's ridiculously short sessions, like 3 and 4 hours at a time. So the majority of my time and my work I'm doing is early mornings and late evenings pre-baiting and trying to find them. And that helps. It's just at the start of the season this year, I was actually lucky enough to bump into two lovely guys at one of the angling shows, the Northern Show. It was Brian Scoyles and Bob Roberts.
Yeah.
We ended up getting a bit of a banging our heads together and sorting out a little bit of an early season carp campaign, which it turned out to be one of the most memorable fishing sessions of our lives, really. For me, especially, just for getting the chance to go and fish with Bob and Brian, it's the two real gents of the angling world, and it was an absolute pleasure to be able to fish with them for a few days. And obviously, over time, we've built up a nice relationship, which is quite nice, actually.
And how did the session go? What did the pre-baiting pay off?
Well, the full story behind it was... we've gone to the angling show, and I went down to speak to Bob Roberts because I know he was poorly at the time. So obviously, me being me, I'm quite a cheeky chap, so it's a case of just going up to him and saying, look, how are you doing, Bob? And with that, we got talking about chub, which obviously got his undivided attention pretty much straight away. And then after that, we got talking about carp, and then Brian Scoyles is pricked up in the background as soon as I mentioned carp, and he said to me, I've caught carp from all over the world, but every time I go to the Trent, I can't seem to catch one. So me being me, I put my foot in it and says, I'll help you catch one. So we banged his head together, got a plan sorted. I had all pre-baiting, hoping for Brian to get his first Trent carp. And on the very first session, we was down there, I managed to land a small one, but in the afternoon, when everything was a bit of a lull period, it all went dead quiet, Brian's into his first carp, which it was, for a river carp, it was 15 pounds something exactly, I can't remember the exact weight, but for a river carp, it's a stunning fish to catch. It really is. Obviously, as the day went on, it kind of died off a little bit, so we left it for probably a week or so, and then Brian rang me back and says, I'm really up for another session. And I was like, yeah, fair enough, we'll organise it. So I carried on trickling just a little bit of boilies in, to be honest, no particles or anything like that, like we did at the start of it, and see if we could hold them. And then obviously I was it was all going ahead and everything was going as we wanted it to. I was at work one day, and the plan was for me to finish work early and come down and meet Brian, so it was just for an afternoon session. So we've gone down for a bit of an afternoon session. I've give Brian a ring probably about 3 o'clock, saying, Brian, I'm going to be about half an hour or so, would you like me to fetch some fish and chips? Brian turns around to me and says, forget the fish and chips, get down here, it's going off. And I've got to the peg, and I'm looking down at the river. Brian's got two carp in the sling and he's playing one.
No way.
And it's like on a river, that doesn't happen very often.
No.
And it's just one of them times in your life where everything went well. And with the rest of the session, we didn't get many more carp, but we carried on getting chub and barbel. It was fantastic. It was a brilliant experience for us both.
And what sort of methods do you catch carp on over there? So conventional sort of lead clip type hook link methods?
Exactly that. We're using lead clips, but obviously with the river, we don't want a fixed lead clip. So what we're tending to do, we've put a smaller swivel in, so it gives it a running rig sort of presentation. A plus as well, if you do hook up anything, it still ejects the lead, which is quite nice. is quite useful, especially on the river, because there's plenty of snags to go at. And the rigs itself, we started off just using probably 14 inches rigs, and then over the time of the session we found that if we lengthened them we seemed to be getting more bites, and I think that was more because, especially with Brian, especially he was using wafters, and especially within the Trent, obviously with the amount of flow there is, if you get the wafter right it works better if you've got a longer rig.
Yeah, it's just moving around more in the flow.
It looks more, a bit more natural to him as well, doesn't it?
So you just think with a short hook link it's springing back just looking really weird.
Yeah, I think they find it intrusive straight away. Like, and the main point of it as well is you've got to fish your lead tight, haven't you? You can't fish slack lines or anything like that on the rivers. So it's a case of your lead's dead tight. You need a fairly good hookling to keep everything away from it.
Have you ever tried a springy hookling, you know, like a trigger link type thing?
No, I haven't actually. It is something I would definitely have a go at some point. It's well worth it, definitely.
Yeah, it just seems so it doesn't look as anchored as artificial was just moving about a bit more, maybe. Or we used to use the pole elastic rigs back in the 80s and stuff, the old confidence rigs, but yeah, something like that seems to me. When you're fishing for other species, do you use the float or whatever? Do you ever pick carp up other ways?
This year I haven't done. This year, it's like I say, they've been very scarce this year. They've been early season, there seems to be a lot more closer to me, because this part of the river is the dike section of the river, so it's not actually the real River Trent, if you like.
Yeah.
It's the part that forks off through the centre of the town. So the flow is a lot different in this section. Mm. This year, they've just not been there. I don't know why that is. They're just not been in the areas as much as there was previously, but you do catch them on the flow, and on some occasions in the summer you can go down with just some dog biscuits and pick one or two off the top as well.
Really?
Yeah, there is certain places you have to work for it, but it is possibility to just go down there and pick a few off the top.
What about zigs? Do you ever use zigs on the river? What's that look like?
No, I wouldn't really ever use them on a river, because with a flow, you're never really going to know where they are. Because obviously each day when the locks open, the flow changes, and it's the undertow in the river is so different to a lake.
Yeah.
It's not something that you would even consider on the river, I don't think. But then again, you never know. You never know. Maybe one day I'll have a go for the chub on the zig, because I can see them eating it.
Hmm. A little birdie told me that you've gone quite in depth on zigs, thermoclimates and stuff. So I was just checking if you're using them on the river, but I presume you'd fish many lakes as well then, if you like the zigs.
Oh yeah. To be honest with you, I'm fishing mad. It's a case of fishing. If there's fish somewhere, I want to catch it. And it doesn't matter what species it is. I want to catch them. I want to catch them all, and I want to catch the bigger ones.
Yeah,
so as we all do.
So what is it with the zigging? Have you got any tips? You got stuff you found out that might help us bag an extra fish?
To be honest with you, with zigs, I've found, obviously, you've got to be very visual with it. And it's one of them things that when you go to a lake, if you're going to fish a zig, have a wander around the lake two or three times and just see where the fish are sitting in the water. You can see if they're a foot underwater or if they're two foot under the water, or they're just off bottom. You can see where they are without putting any rigs in the water. Mm. And I think for me with zig fishing, I think that's the biggest key to it, is not going to your lake and rushing to get to your pet. Take your time to actually get to know the lake and look where the fish are naturally sitting. Mm. Not just the carp, look at the roach. Look where the roach are sitting in the water. If you find a thermocline, if you were to put a plate across it, the roach are all sat perfectly on the same thermocline as a carp are. So if you find them, they're pretty much in the same depth of water.
Right. That's useful. Like certain lakes, there's ways to locate fish by looking at other stuff. You know, I know lakes where they were always where the birds were. You know, wherever there was a load of ducks, like the fish were never too far away from them. And sometimes the opposite. Even if you don't see any fish, you just go, there's a load of ducks at the end of the lake. I guarantee the carp are not there because you never see them together. But
that's it.
I hadn't really thought about roach, and that's just the temperature, you think.
Yeah, I think all the fish, at the end of the day, obviously carp are warm-blooded, they're a bit more warm-blooded than roach, but they will sit at a similar sort of depth in the water to the other fish, because that's where the warmest part of the lake is. Yeah. And I think that goes to say, in a river, I don't think there's a thermocline as much, because it's always flowing, but I bet there's still areas where they hold up in a certain depth. where they feel comfortable, but it's probably a degree warmer or a quarter of a degree warmer than the rest of the river. I mean, it's the same principle, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's, you know, they're comfort fish, aren't they? Especially carp. Yeah. They're sun lovers, aren't they? So they're always in the most comfortable place, the backs of the winds, any sort of slacks. And do you find that in the river, that the carp hold up in those sort of areas, a little bit of slack water sort of off the main flow?
Yeah, you do tend to, definitely in the river, you do tend to see, you find them more in the slacks, 100%. And they do lie up in weed beds, and they're very much like they do in the lakes. Carp are lazy, aren't they? They eat when they have to eat, which is most of the time. And the best place for them for eating all the time is in the margins and around the weed.
Yeah.
It's like a natural holding point for them, and that's, I think that's the rivers and lakes.
Yeah, they're quite habitual as well, but it is probably you know, for some real obvious reason that maybe we can't see or whatever, but I'm sure that's why they go back to the same places. Do you find that on the rivers that certain times of year they like different bits of the stretch? Or
I find this time of year especially, obviously with all the leaves falling in the water, and I think, I honestly do believe, with the leaves hitting them in the face and debris hitting them in the face, I think it really puts them off. For this time of year especially, try and keep away from anywhere that they've got leaf debris or any debris coming through. I think that goes for the same in lakes as well. I think, I'm pretty certain that it does. If you get poked in the face a few times, eventually you're going to say, actually, I don't quite like that, I'm going to keep away from that area.
Yeah, I think the leaves give off something nasty as well. I don't think it's just maybe the impact. I think it's
it's the breakdown, doesn't it? It's natural gases coming off of it and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the old ones that are rotted into sort of silt and stuff, they get the bloodworm. I think it's fine then, but I think while they're decomposing, they give off some repellent or something fish don't like. So yeah, but we always used to find that on the northern mares in autumn. Quite often you'd find the fish on the area that was on the back of the prevailing winds, like the previous year. The fish had, they sort of learned. That's what I always thought anyway. I've been making it up. So you're looking for stretches with no trees, basically, in the autumn.
No. You can go where there's trees, but it's debris going into the river. That's what you've got to watch. And I think that's a big no-no. Is if you've got overhanging trees and you can see there's leaves constantly falling in that area, it's possibly not a good idea to try and, if you say, for instance, you're using a stick float or something like that, try and push maggots through that gap, because it's just, they just don't like it.
Yeah. What's but can you think of a special capture on the river? Is the one that stands out?
Yeah, for me it was 2 weeks ago. But it's not a carp, by the way.
Okay.
But it does stand out. I just had my personal best barbel, which is 15.7.
Nice.
It's actually in Angling Times this week. Mm. And do you know what? The PB side of it is not the special bit. I actually caught it on my wedding anniversary.
No way.
Yeah, she let me out on my wedding anniversary. So for me, that is one of those special moments.
Is there a story behind the capture? Is it we fishing in the evening, I guess?
Yeah, it was, to be fair, I come back from work, I got home from work, wife, because I normally go fishing on a Wednesday evening and a Monday evening. On this day, because it was our wedding anniversary, obviously I come in sulking, as you do, to see if I could angle my way out. And she says, look, because we're going away at the weekend, you can go fishing tonight. So obviously with that, I've got change as quick as you can imagine, and I'm on the bank within 20 minutes. I'm out the door and gone. bear in mind, it was only a really short session. She gave me 2.5 hours. I got 2.5 hours to go out, obviously do what I can, get home for my tea.
Yeah.
And in that session, I managed to get a PB in 2.5 hours.
Did you know where to go?
Well, to be honest with you, because I'm local to this area, I'm priming quite a few spots. It's not just one area I'm priming, it's lots of spots. I'm not concentrating on one peg. I'm forever moving.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key as well. I think you've got to have a real good quality bait, and you keep introducing it, and you introduce it everywhere. I'm quite convinced, in this stretch, the bait that I'm feeding at the minute, I think they're looking at it as a natural food source. I'm quite convinced of it.
just and because of the regularity.
Yeah, and it's all species. It's not just the barbel. I've had big roach, massive bream, these carp, chub, and they're all taking boilers.
Mm. Do you think that's better for them? I remember sort of early days when the river guys for barbel and stuff started piling the boilers in. I think it's a good thing for the for boilers to be the staple diet of the river.
I think realistically, how much am I going to have to put in to actually unbalance the staple diet for a river? I don't think you can ever overbait a river, because I think eventually it's going to roll off, or it's just going to blow and disappear.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever going to get to a point where they're all eating it, so it's all gone. And I can't afford to put the amount of bait in to do that, because you'd have to put Arctic lorry loads of it in, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So you think pre-baiting's the key, obviously, on a big, long river where the fish can move, you know, a hell of a lot. You're training them to stay in areas, are you, I guess?
Yeah. I call it the bird table effect.
Yeah.
They're coming back to that area regularly. And they're just feeding on there naturally, because it's there for them. It's the same as you. If somebody leaves a steak for you at the same place every day, you're going to keep going back for it.
Yeah. Well, with the flow and everything, I mean, do you find the carp still feed throughout the winter, or like more compared to a lake?
I do believe they do feed a lot more confident in the winter, and I think purely because they've got to work against the flow.
Hmm.
And I think, obviously, with them moving and swimming more, the metabolism's working more, so they've got to eat more. And I do think, where on a lake, you'd probably ease back on bait a bit. In the river, I don't think you've got to do that with carp, because I think they're as active as they are in the summer, because they're used to it. They're always... It's, in a lake, obviously, they've got they're not moving, they're not fighting against any sort of current. The Trent's quite a torrent river sometimes.
Yeah.
If you get a bit of water in it, it's brutal out there.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. They've got to keep moving, can't they? They can't just lay up and you know, we get a load of rain and it flies through. And is there a certain time you look into fish, like, you know, a certain flow strength, or do you know if it's like 3 days after the rain, or like is there something specific that you'd like you wouldn't miss?
There's one. It's the falling river. A falling river. If you've had a real good, say you've had a couple of weeks of heavy rain, it's been up. The river's really up. And then you get a falling river. A falling river is, for me, it's been the most productive.
Yeah.
And it's happened on more than one occasion as well. So it's not just like a one-off sort of situation.
For carp and everything, or...?
For everything, yeah. I don't know what it is. I think it does something in the water, and they all go mental. And we're in a lake, obviously, I'd react to low pressure, and I've reacted to low pressure on the river, and it don't quite work the same. It's more to what's happening with water levels on the river.
And do you notice any moon effect on the river? I always remember the first sort of moon phases when everyone said the new moon was great. It was for barbel originally. So do you think there's a big effect on the river?
In theory, the moon phases should be more effective on a river, because the lunar pole is more realistic to happen on a river than it would a lake, because it's flowing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I can't say I've caught more fish on a full moon.
Right.
Than I have any other time.
Fair enough.
I don't think on a river, I don't think it's quite the same for some reason, but you would have thought it would have affected it a bit more.
With
the moon phases.
So do you prefer river fishing than lakes? I guess it's less busy, less commercial.
It's the mystery. It's the mystery behind it for me. A lake, don't get me wrong, you know you can go to lakes and you've got 50 pounders in there, but you know they're 50 pounders in there, and you know they've been caught. On the river, you never really know what you're going to catch, and you never know. One day you might catch that 50 pounder that nobody ever knew was there.
So,
and that mystery is gets me excited, really excited.
So you think there's almost definitely big carp that have never been caught?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I don't think we're even scratching the surface with it on the rivers.
What wouldn't surprise you then, if there were three different 50s in a year? Could you see that happening?
I wouldn't go up as far as 50s, but it wouldn't surprise me if a few 40s come out.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me. Obviously, he's got history of 40s already, but a true river 40 is a humongous fish, isn't it, in this country?
Oh, yeah.
So if they are there, it's a miracle fish, but there's a good possibility. I'm quite confident they're out there, definitely.
Have you had a few escapees into the river from like local sort of well-known car?
Well, it's quite funny actually. You know A1 Pits?
Yeah.
Pit 6, they lost their big common, didn't they?
Yeah.
That went into the Trent, and that's in this stretch somewhere, but it's not been out for a couple of years.
So it has been caught in the river?
Yeah, it got caught at Collingham Weir. It's been caught, come out a couple of times last season.
And has it lost weight or gained weight, would you say, since it's been in the river?
It's lost weight, but it's longer.
Yeah.
I think it was 38 something last time it was out. So it's lost what, £6, £7? It was £42 when it left, I think.
Right.
Something like that when it got out.
You'd expect it to, wouldn't you, with the exercise and you know, having to...
Oh, most definitely. It'll have a chest like God knows what now.
But you think it's physically lengthened as well since it's been in there?
Well, I think they have to. That's their way of dealing with it. They lose that fat, actually lengthen off. Well, they probably just look lean and they don't like get any bigger.
Hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. So a few 40s swimming by. I mean, what's your best carp from the river?
My personal is it's £20.
Right.
So it's only a baby. But like I say, I took Brian at the start of the season to help him catch one, and he beat my PB on his second session. Right. He had a 22 out.
A 30 is pretty rare as well, then, would you say?
They are rare. They are rare, but they are out there. There's a few people. You may have heard of Mitch Godfrey.
No, I don't think so. Is he another Nottingham angler?
Yeah, he's a Nottingham angler. He does a lot around Nottingham city centre and around that area. And he's done a couple of books actually with Rob Malin. Yeah. And he's a really interesting guy, and he's had some phenomenal fish. Wasn't this season, but start of last season, he had two, I think it was 30s out in the first session of the season.
Wow. This is pretty impressive. Do you do sessions on there? Do you bivvy up or?
I don't tend to, because I struggle obviously with having a family. It's hard to commit to it all. Mm. So I have to try and fit it all in. I have one or two here and there, but a lot of the stretches now you can't night fish.
All right.
So it makes it quite difficult. So you're stuck, and by 11 o'clock at night you've got to start thinking about packing up and coming home.
It's hard, isn't it? I guess a lot of, especially modern anglers that are used to just having really comfortable big bivvies and all the kit around them, I guess the river fishing's a bit daunting to them.
Oh, most definitely. Some of the pegs, they're a nightmare to get into. Absolute nightmare.
So it's just travelling light, day fishing. I guess that just puts people off.
Yeah, oh yeah, most definitely. But you can cover a lot of ground, that's the thing. And don't get me wrong, I travel fairly light. I've got a barra, but you know what it's like. You get on your barra and you can walk quite a fair way.
Hmm.
It's just a case of hunting them down, isn't it? And if you're feeding so many areas, you can go back and check. And if your bait's gone, you know there's a good chance that the fish have been feeding. All the wildlife's at it.
It must be hard work going back to a lake when you've sort of had the freedom of the river. And are you down there just not seeing many people very often? Or?
You very rarely see anybody. You get the odd one or two dog walkers here and there, but you don't really see anybody. There's a couple of regular anglers I bump into, but even them, you don't tend to see anybody at all, really.
Wow. Carp heaven.
Yeah, it's quite good, and I'm the kind of person that I tend to try and hide from the people anyway.
Yeah.
It makes it easier.
I believe you do some tuitions as well, do you, occasionally?
Well, it's not really tuitions. It was a friendly sort of helping out a couple of friends. That it started off as, can you give me an hand? And before you know it, I ended up doing four or five different kind of... wasn't really professional tuitions, but they all made me have some money from it, if you like.
Yes.
Like, look, you've put your time in, you wanted to do it, you're having this. I was like, oh God. I didn't really... It's nerve-wracking, isn't it? It's not, I go fishing for my own ends, nothing. It's nice to give other people tips, but...
Do people want to know how to fish the river, or is it just sort of general fishing?
I get quite a lot of people asking. I do get a lot of people asking about the river.
Hmm. Yeah, it's like, especially carp fishing on the river, it's not something that everybody gets a chance to do. So, you know, there's all these people that go to France all the time, there's so much sort of probably better fishing in the rivers, and but it's just a bit scary. Even I think about it and think, oh blimey, how big leads do I need to take, what gear do I need to change? It just takes you out of your comfort zone even thinking about it. So yeah, it's, but you're saying all your gear is fairly similar to what you'd use in a lake?
Yeah, pretty much. And to be honest with you, a lot of my carp fishing on the river, I go down to probably 2.25 pound test curve rods.
Right. Why so light? Just because you're travelling light and not casting far?
Well, you haven't got to cast as far. And to be honest with you, if you've got a good set of rods and you hook a good fish, a 2.25 test curve rod can they're pretty good, powerful rods. You can stop them.
Mm.
It's the other thing, you catch lots of other nuisance species as well. So if you was fishing 3 pound test curve rods or 2.75, it just takes the fun out of it.
Yeah, I guess all those old days of having to find your tackle down to catch chub and stuff, and people are catching them on 15 pound line and 25 pound hooklinks, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So my uplinks at the minute, for the last two seasons, all I've used is a 15 pound soft supple braid.
Yeah, and what just like a knotless knot? Sort of size hooks are you using on the river?
It depends on the situation and where I'm fishing, but it's between tens and sixes, and obviously size of the baits as well.
Yeah, and do you hair rig everything, like for the barbel, for the chub as well?
Yeah, I do air rig absolutely everything.
It always makes me, when I speak to people who fish the river, it always makes me want to have a dabble, but like you say, it takes me out of my comfort zone. So
it's getting past, once you get down there and get used to seeing your tips a little bit higher and you kind of get your head round how it's going to work. It's not so bad, because you've not got to worry about line concealment as much as you would on a lake.
Yeah,
because they don't really see it as much. And with the main reason for me using braids and stuff like that is because I'm a strong believer that with the river, they've not seen many hooks and they've not seen many hooklings. With braid, they're picking the bait up and they've got it in the mouth and they can't feel it. They can't actually feel the braid at all, so they're just confidently walking, going around, just munching it all.
Yeah, do fish, like, are they, do you get a lot of repeat captures? Are you recognising the fish that you catch from same stretches, or do they really?
I've had a few repeat captures on barbel, but not carp.
Really?
I have heard of, like I say, as a friend of mine, Mitch Godfrey. I've heard of him catching quite a few repeat captures. He's actually got a fish that they've named. They've called it Raggy Tail. It's on the Trent at Nottingham, and that's a common that he's had a few times now. I think he's had it 4 times.
Wow.
so that kind of goes against them being nomadic in one respect, because he's catching it in a similar sort of area and it's the same fish. So
yeah, I suppose
you must have residents that hold up and feel comfortable in areas, but I think the majority of them tend to move off.
Yeah, I guess it depends if there's a lot of food in that area, whether it's anglers or natural or whatever. It could be just
area
they like staying. Have you ever had a go on any of the big rivers abroad? Have you been tempted? Or
I haven't, but I'd like to have a go. I would like to have a go at the one in Canada.
That's
the one for me. St. Lawrence, that's the one. It looks like the sea, but I think it would be well worth it.
There's a fantastic river that runs through Croatia and Slovenia called the River Sava. I've had a look at it. It's stunning, but it's got big everything in, 25 kilo carp and huge zander. Do you ever have a go for the predatory stuff in the river?
I do, but I've not been doing too well on them. It's getting to that time of year now. I'm going to have another go later on in November. I've got a few things I need to iron out before I start on it, but I'm definitely going to have a go at the zander and the pike.
Would you fish for them with the law?
No, to be honest with you, the zander, I'm planning to have a go at them slightly different to the conventional way. I'm going to quiver tip for them.
Right.
Because obviously they are very finicky biters, and I do believe if you quiver tip for them, I think you'll get a lot more results.
Right. Have you ever heard of anyone picking carp up when they've been law fishing on the river?
I haven't, no. I have in lakes. I've actually seen it in lakes, but I've never seen it on the river.
So what, you've not had it happen to yourself?
No, never.
You've just watched it?
Yeah.
And what is it, like, how big a lure do you think a carp would take? I mean, I keep hearing about it, I've never witnessed it, but...
Well, it's fry, isn't it? Well, they're not going to go for anything above 2 centimetres, well, 4 or 5 centimetres, are they? I think when the carp are eating fish, I think they're going for the fry more than anything, and the people who are catching them drop-shotting. I don't think they'd go for a big plug or a lure like that. But I know they do, but...
Yeah.
I don't know, I just can't see it.
I believe you're a good photographer as well. You're pretty good with the tips, I suppose. Are you into the sort of nature side of the rivers? I bet there's a lot to photograph down there.
There is, and I wouldn't say I'm a good photographer. I'm learning.
Right.
It's one of them things, you never stop. I'm quite fortunate to have a neighbour that's a professional photographer, and he spent a little bit of time with me getting to understand like the manual settings and stuff like that. And there's a big key with photography, isn't it? It's understanding how your camera works.
Yeah.
And it's nothing worse. It's nighttime camera work is frustrating.
Yeah, it's something I've still never got my head around. It's always on the green auto button. I've had people do nighttime settings for me on my camera, but I just can't get my head around that sort of the light aperture.
It's what it actually does. Field, isn't it? You've got to get your depth of field right, and if you ramp your IOS up inside the highest it can be and put your depth of field kind of in line with that, you can see it, because your depth of field is like the eye, if you like.
Mm.
So when your eye widens up, it gives you a bit more depth of field, so it takes more light in.
Yeah.
So that sometimes helps quite a lot, but it's still really difficult in low light conditions, especially with no backdrop light. You need a bit of backdrop, really.
So all I need to do is to have somebody like you to ring up at 3 o'clock in the morning and catch a big one.
Well, that's happened to me quite a few times around here. A couple of my mates ringing me up. Are you going to come down and take some pictures?
Yeah. What's the biggest carp you took a picture of then on the river?
My biggest I've took a picture of is 28.
Right. That's it.
And that was in the centre of town, actually, at Bob's Bell Island.
So they find the carp in the sort of busier areas then in the town? Do you think they like the noise? Or?
It's warmer. And
of course.
In the centre of town as well, there's like a floating restaurant.
Right.
And the out of bounds part of the river, you can see them there. They're there all the time.
Yeah.
They know that's warm there. They know there's food coming out of that boat all the time. So they're actively just sat under there, winter and summer.
There must have been a few sneaky sessions gone down in there somehow.
Not for me, but there has been.
Yeah.
There has been.
And I guess they catch well, have you?
I've heard some really good stories from there. Really good. But it's a case of you've got to, if you're going to do it, you have to go on a kayak, because the bailiff is very strict.
Really? So people patrolling it all the time?
Yeah, the bailiff around here is fantastic. He does a brilliant job.
Mm.
He really does. He's had quite a lot of trouble in the past as well, so I think that's why he's got so strict.
And right.
The out of bounds, he's out of bounds. He's on it. If you're on there, he'll be on you quicker than you can blink.
Yeah.
But I suppose that's his job though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just nice to know there's like, all right, if you want to do a bit of sneaking around, maybe it's an inconvenience, but it's nice to know that somebody's looking, you know, got the best interest of the river at heart, I guess.
Yeah, most definitely.
Do you see lots of, I'm concerned about, like, I mean, maybe it's better living near a river, maybe it gives like young kids somewhere to fish, kind of from the off. I'm concerned about people getting into normal fishing, float fishing, quiver tipping, whatever. Like, there's a lot of people bypassing that now, getting straight into carp fishing. When do you see kids, have your local clubs got junior sections?
Do you know, you don't see as many now as you used to. It's all dried out a little bit, which is a shame, because like you say, for angling, like most people, their first ever experience is either on a canal or on a river.
Mm.
And that's kind of disappearing now, because obviously with the way media is, everybody seems to be wanting to go straight away. They want to go for carp, they bypass everything else, which really you need to, if you learn everything else, the carp will come in time. but people don't tend to see it like that anymore, do they?
I think it's a bigger step to get into fishing though, if like your first bit of fishing you've got to buy rods, you know, alarms, carp gear is not expensive, whereas most people who sort of start on a farmer's pond or a river or whatever, you know, you can, like say you're walking out with one rod, you know, and whatever your rig is tied up to it, and it, you know, you can get out there with £15 worth of equipment, as of where the entry level for carp's much higher, I think, so there's probably less people.
Which is a shame, really, because you'd think with the way things are with the fishing industry, you'd have thought really it should push it more for people to, for the younger generation to do it, because it's cheaper for them to go and have a go on the rivers and on the canals.
Yeah, can you remember your first time? Have you always lived near the river? Was that your first ever fishing experience?
My first ever fishing experience was on a river. Yeah. Yeah. And I've not always lived on a river. My granddad was a keen angler, and he taught me the ways from a very, very young age. The old fashioned way to snap a branch off a tree and tie some lie to it.
Yeah, was that the first fishing rod was a branch?
It was, yes.
And what was your first fish? What was the species?
It was a perch.
Yeah, everyone's first fish is a perch, isn't it?
It seems to be, doesn't it? The thing is, I've had some perch when I was younger that I've never been able to match since.
No way. Is a good perch in the river there?
Yeah, there's a fair few good perch. You don't really tend to see a lot of perch anglers down here, to be honest.
No, not the carpers in the winter with the drop shotting craze or anything.
You get the odd one or two here and there, but you don't get a lot. That goes to say, with the whole of the river, you don't tend to see that many people. You've got certain areas, which, like, there's a place called Winthorpe Rack, which is near the A1 bridge.
Yeah.
Do you know where the A1 pits is?
Yeah, yeah.
That area gets absolutely chocker.
I see bivvies there when I'm driving past the A1. Is that same spot?
That's the one, yeah, yeah. At the start of the season, it was like a mother's tea party there. It was just, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But everybody seems to go to that same area.
Because you can bivvy up. It's comfortable probably. From the road.
240 miles long, surely.
Well, you look
section.
You look how busy A1 pits is at the weekend, and literally just down the road, you know, you've got hundreds of miles of river where you're probably not going to see anybody. It seems crazy that we're all sat around a little round lake or something looking at each other.
It's each their own, isn't it? It's each their own. Some people prefer that, don't they? It's what you get out of your fishing, isn't it? It's all personal challenges.
As I say, I think the river's a bit daunting to people sometimes, you know. What if the river comes up in the night or rains, or can't hold my leads to the bottom, or it's just a load of things to be fearful of that probably don't ever concern you, do they?
Not really, no, because you've got phones nowadays, you've got internet pretty much wherever you go, and if you haven't, you can take an internet booster. You can pretty much watch the water levels. Obviously, if you're fishing the tidal trend, it's slightly different, because you've got to be really on the ball, because the water can change really quickly.
Yeah.
But majority of the middle trend, you haven't got to worry about it that much. And as long as you keep your eye on the weather forecasts and you're not stupid, you're absolutely fine.
Have you found the carps go up into like the saline areas or the
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. You get no end of carp in the tidal trend.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Quite a lot come out this year as well. Just what I've seen through social media, there's been a large number of carp coming out of tidal trend.
Why do you think that is? Do you think they like the salt, or?
I don't know, to be honest, because I've never really thought about it that much. Because you've got Dunholm Bridge and stuff like that. That area of the Trent's always produced carp, and that's pretty much salty water there. That's all tidal.
You have a flatfish and a carp in the same session.
Or catch a flatfish and then the carp eats the flatfish, you never know.
Yeah, it seems crazy. Well, maybe if I ever get a chance to head to the Nottingham area, I'll book you as the guide, I think.
I'd like to take you down there, mate, even if it's just for a few hours. It'd be interesting sessions.
Yeah, I've spent a bit of time around that sort of area, but I never had a go on the river. I've fished the A1 pits a couple of times, but next time I'm down there I should try and get a night on the river or an afternoon. I don't know what's the traditional session? Just if you're going to do the day, would you go all day? Would you go lunchtime for the evening? Or
it's pretty much the same as a lake, really. If you're in the middle of the day, the brightest part of the day has never been the best. You want to be early morning for a few hours, go home, have breakfast, and then come back for 4 o'clock time and sit it out.
Let's do the evening stint.
The evening seems to be more productive.
Seems nice if you're local. And on the odd times you've done the nights, like when we used to fish the river at Preston, we used to just do overnights, and as soon as it got dark, that's when the chub started, occasional barbel, you know, it's like somebody flicked a switch until about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it used to completely dry up, and then that'd be it. Is there anything similar there? I bet you don't do that many nights.
No, I don't really do that many nights, and when I have done them in the past, you get probably a spell about 3 o'clock in the morning, but then that seems to be it until first light.
Right.
But the main feeding spell, really, what I've worked out around here especially, is last light is the most important.
Yeah.
Just getting that last bit of light, and that's for all species as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something about the light changes that trigger fish to feed. We used to think, like years ago when it wasn't common to night fish anywhere, that it was just because they knew there was food there and it was safe to eat, but it's still the same now, even though lakes are probably fished more at night than they are in the daytime. Certainly carp lakes, but people do overnight is more than they do a day session. But
of course you do. Most people that do fishing now, they are there for a day on their quick overnight in between work days, or trying to fit it in over the weekends.
Yeah,
I think most people are doing that now.
Well, we've been there 45 minutes, I would like to thank you for giving us a bit of insight into the Nottingham Trent area, and it made me want to go on the river. But
well, there's always time, mate. There's always time. You never know what's going to happen.
The Carpcast is sponsored by Clearwater Fisheries, the North's premier fishery complex. For more details, visit clearwaterfisheries.co.uk. Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.